Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this month's City Talks, where we'll be discussing inclusive growth. What is it? Why has it become so important? And what policies are needed to achieve it? Before we get to that, I'm joined by my colleagues Alex Jones and Naomi Clayton to discuss last week's spring budget, the last ever, apparently. Let's turn to the spring budget. Probably the biggest surprise in the budget was the number of jokes, but aside from that, I think it was a recognition there were less city-specific announcements than in previous budgets, but still several policy areas that will have big impacts on cities: business rates relief, changes to self-employment tax rates, and new technical qualifications for 16 to 18-year-olds. It was a strong emphasis by the Chancellor on improving technical skills. For example, he announced the introduction of new T levels to sit alongside A levels and lifelong learning pilots. Naomi, talk us through some of the announcements and what we think the implications for cities will be.
Yeah. As you say, Andrew, we saw the introduction of the new T levels, which is an interesting innovation, and that will be accompanied by an increase in the number of hours of training and the introduction of maintenance loans for those studying technical courses, all with the aim of creating essentially greater parity between this kind of technical and academic routes. And I suppose really here it's important to ensure that the new T levels are meaningful and useful in the workplace, and that equips people not just for jobs but for careers.
Mm. And Alex, this picks up the Prime Minister's claim or wish to have an economy and a country that works for all. This is about non-university education and trying to recognise and improve that.
Absolutely. And I think it's a really good sign that they're really focusing on technical skills. I mean, this is a problem that's been around for decades, and successive governments have tried to tackle it. So the idea of T-levels in and of themselves, it's not new. There have been various initiatives before that are similar, but I think there's a real opportunity around T-levels to take it seriously. I think Naomi's point, this has got to work for employers and for individuals, is the key thing. So it's about how you implement this and how you make sure you stick at it. So rather than changing things again in a few years' time, making sure this is something that is seen as established and it's here to stay.
That's a good point. The other big sort of political issue, I think, was around the tax increases on self-employment. I talked a little bit about how the changing nature of work is not only impacting those in the labour market and those outside, but actually government tax revenues as well. Say something about that, Naomi. What do you think about that?
We'll be exploring the issue of self-employment and the rises in kind of non-standard forms of employment in our Future of Work programme this year, looking at just how much self-employment has risen in different parts of the country and what the kind of nature of that work looks like. And obviously, that links to the government's kind of tax revenues and tax takes in different parts of the country.
And again, interesting, Alex, that part of the Prime Minister's response to the criticism of the increase was a response around fairness.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting looking at the work by the Resolution Foundation that shows that this reform will actually hit the best paid very much the hardest. It's quite a kind of significant curve. So I think the ideas around fairness, around making sure that given the way that work across the country is changing, people should be ensuring they pay tax and contribute, is a really interesting one. It's interesting, it's paid quite badly politically, with many Conservative MPs in particular very concerned about the implications for entrepreneurship. Although some of the press now are saying that it's not gone down as badly in some of their constituencies. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, but very much the attempt to update the tax system for some of the new ways of working that are becoming much more widespread, I think that's what's behind it. And I think that's a welcome thing to keep looking at updating it.
Yeah. I suppose the third area that got quite a lot of coverage beforehand, in part because of some of the much-trailed work on the effect that the business rates increases soon to be introduced are going to be had. The budget introduced additional reliefs for those firms that were particularly affected. So because we did some analysis on the impact of that relief, which revealed some interesting findings. Alex, you need to say a little bit more about what they were.
Sure. So, I mean, it was striking. The Chancellor absolutely felt the need to respond to what was a big campaign around transitional relief for business rates, which actually affected businesses most in London and Reading as cities. So when we looked at the relief measures they brought in, we found that it will benefit, on average, firms in only 12 English cities, most of them in the greater southeast. So London firms are set to enjoy rates relief of around £477 million. In contrast, lots of other cities in England, so some of the more deprived areas that have been paying more than they should have been for some time, are actually going to miss out on some of the rates decreases. So Manchester firms set to stamp up £42 million more in rates than they would have done before the relief measures were announced.
Yeah, I think many people appreciated or anticipated that, which I think in some respects runs counter to some of the government's ambitions around rebalancing the economy and to see growth and conditions more equal across different parts of the country.
Absolutely. I mean, it was surprising to people when we said that. When we said, actually, this is benefiting most cities in the country. You can't deny that there are businesses in London significantly affected by the fact that revaluation hadn't taken place for so long. And there are some big problems around more frequent revaluation, making sure that arguably it's not a fixed yield, it's a fixed rate. So you're not trying to get the same amount from everywhere, which means London firms are paying more. But certainly ensuring that if you're a firm in some of the less successful cities, you're not paying as much for business rates. And if you're a firm in London, you're paying that much more. That makes sense. And I think ensuring we make more of that in the years to come will be important for a country that works for all.
Yeah, yeah, good point. Last week also saw the launch of the final report from the Inclusive Growth Commission. And we'll be talking about the detail of inclusive growth and what the commission was saying later on. But before we get to that, Naomi, just give us a sense as to what the commission report was saying, some of the highlights, and then we'll just have a conversation about the implications for cities in that.
Well, I suppose, you know, the commission covered lots of ground. At its core was the idea of integrating economic and social policy and kind of reintroducing the idea of a whole systems approach to inclusive growth. So building on kind of the kind of past initiatives such as Total Place and community budgets, really to kind of make significant improvements to the way that services are delivered, deliver better outcomes and cost savings as well. And important to this is allowing places greater flexibility in the way that they spend funds. And also this kind of idea that we don't just need better jobs, that we need more jobs and growth. And that's where the kind of focus on the demand side comes in and the focus on industrial strategies.
Yeah, and encouragingly, I think it had at the heart of much of its analysis and policy recommendations the overwhelming priority and focus on education and skills as a prerequisite to thinking about these issues, which is
absolutely
good.
Yeah, I mean, it's necessary but not sufficient, but it's absolutely fundamental. And that's certainly what we found when you look at cities around the country. The thing that would make most difference to them and to the people who live in them, most importantly, is skills and education.
Yeah. And Alex, obviously, we are the centre for cities. By definition, we think about cities as being the engines of economic growth up and down the country, job creation. We know that the majority of this stuff takes place in our urban areas compared to our rural areas. What's the role of cities in both being that engine, but also ensuring that more people can take advantage of and get the benefits from the growth that occurs in our cities?
Well, I mean, I think we argue that cities drive growth because that's what the evidence shows us, that actually much of particularly the fast growing knowledge-intensive businesses are increasingly locating in city centres. So those jobs, though, are being taken by and those businesses are being supplied by people and businesses all across city regions and beyond. So many of those living in rural areas supply businesses in city centres or work in those city centres. So it's a much more interactive economy than is often understood. I think from our perspective, given that these are choices being made by businesses, government can tweak them a bit, but actually fundamentally businesses are deciding this. We need to get better at making the most of that growth. So we need to think much more about the roles of different places. What role does Oldham play in the Greater Manchester economy as compared to Manchester? We need to get better at making sure people living in those areas have the skills and the transport and the housing that enables them to access those jobs. And we need to look at what else needs to be done, because skills, housing and transport are necessary. They're not sufficient. So we need to be thinking much more about the city-region economies, how they work, and how you make the most of what is happening already, which is fast-growing businesses growing fastest in the city centres.
No, I mean, anything to add to that, and thinking about how we, now how we make sure our cities are generating the jobs and growth that clearly we need, not only in the cities themselves, but we need at the national level as well.
Well, I think it's important that when we're thinking about place-based industrial strategies, that there's not just a focus on sectors, and it doesn't equate to cluster policy. What we really need to do is get the balance right and the policy mix right at the local level, so that we're enabling businesses to benefit from concentrating together in one place, and that we're managing the costs of that growth as well.
I mean, yeah, the industrial strategy is not something I'm going to talk in detail about, but clearly it's something that's got to work for everywhere, but it's got to make the most of the different strengths of different areas and different people. Mm. I think making the most of cities will be really important in this, and I think certainly at the Centre for Cities, one of the things that will be starting in the next few weeks is a bigger conversation with lots of people about how do you make the most of city-driven growth? You know, how do you make sure that... If that's a big part of economic growth, but not the total, you do get economic growth in rural areas too. But how do you make the most of the places, the cities, which are driving growth? How do you do more to make sure that is inclusive? And I think we'll be starting a wider conversation, as I say, with lots of different people to work out what are some of the policy measures you could take to make sure that happens.
Great. My thanks to Alex and Naomi. Everyone seems to be talking about inclusive growth. It underpins the Prime Minister's ambition for a country and an economy that works for everyone, where no one and no place is left behind. And it's also central to President Trump's America First economic and job policies. But like many commonplace ideas and terms, behind the words lies a wide range of perspectives, assumptions and ideologies. Some are new, but many are very old. To unpack the term inclusive growth and provide some clarity on what it is and what it isn't, why it's become such a hot topic recently and how it can be achieved, I'm joined by Katie Schmucker, Head of Policy at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and Neil Lee, Associate Professor of Economic Geography at the London School of Economics. So let's start with some basics. Katie, just give us a sense as to what do we mean when we talk about inclusive growth? What is the concept, the notions behind those terms?
I think really it's about trying to get back to basics in a way. It's asking what is growth actually for? And for us at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, growth is essentially about creating jobs, which then is people's vehicle through which they can escape poverty, through which they can improve their living standards. And that really is what the sort of purpose of growth is. And inclusive growth is about thinking, how certain are we that that is what growth is delivering for us? We recently had the publication of the Inclusive Growth Commissioned by the RSA. Mm. And I think they had a really nice way of describing this. And they talked about inclusive growth as being about the experience of growth. Mm-hmm. So for an individual, for a family, what does it actually mean to be in the labour market, to be working, to be earning, and what that means then for your living standards? Do you have enough money to escape poverty through work? And for us, this is an idea whose time has come, and there are kind of lots of signals that this is an issue that needs to be taken seriously at the moment, but I think we'll probably come
to
talk about
we'll come on to the why is it such a hot topic now. But Neil, give us a sense as to what, you know, from your point of view, what do you understand the term inclusive growth to mean? And I suppose, I mean, given what Katie's just said, is it any different from growth more generally?
Yeah. So look, so the idea of inclusive growth is not as new as we think it is. Mm. So it's been sort of knocking around places like the World Bank and some of the other sort of, well, the United Nations type institutions for a while. Yeah. And it's basically its concern, like you say, with the sort of, not just the pace of growth, but also the pattern of growth, or its sort of, you know, its sort of shape, so who benefits. So it's sort of, you know, it's been going on for a while, and it's, I mean, the other thing to sort of think about it is that it's sort of a, it's the next phase of thinking about how growth might address poverty. So we used to have this thing called pro-poor growth, mm. where you sort of focus growth on just on the very poorest, and this is a sort of broader sort of a way of thinking about it. So it's not entirely new, it's been sort of knocking around. And it's basically become popular amongst cities and sort of local governments across the world over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, you know, pretty much in the aftermath of the financial crisis and the sort of problems we've seen in people's living standards.
Yeah. Okay, so let's say a little bit more then, Katie, about why it's now become such a hot topic, not only, as Neil was saying, not only in the UK or not only amongst local practitioners, you know, people like us that think about how growth happens in different places up and down the country, but it happens, you know, it's a World Bank question, it's an OECD question, it's a World Economic Forum question, lots of conversations. It's an international problem as well as a local and a national problem. Why? Why are we all in this space? Why are we all talking about it?
Well, certainly from a UK point of view, I think we've reached a real kind of fork in the road where it used to be that poverty was a problem for people who are not in work. We've now tipped a threshold, and the majority of people who are experiencing poverty in the UK are living in a working household. That's 55% of people in the UK experiencing poverty are living in a household where at least one person is in work. Mm. That's 3.8 million workers in the UK in poverty. And I think that, you know, that's gone up by a million in 10 years. And I think for us, that says something that's very important about the labour market and how it's working or not working for people in different situations. Now, some of that is about social security and benefits. It's not all about the labour market, but some of it also is about work and is about patterns of growth. I think there's a second part to this, which is about productivity. Mm-hmm. We've talked for a long time in this country about our poor productivity performance. It's not just a recent post-financial crisis problem. It is a long-standing problem, the gap in our productivity to some of our competitor nations. And we think it's really interesting if you look into the data around productivity that you actually see a lot of that productivity problem is laying in some of those industries where you have very high levels of low-paid, low-skilled jobs. Mm. Those same jobs that are contributing to the problem that we have of in-work poverty in the UK. And we tend not to think about that sort of bottom end of the labour market as being an important part of our growth story. Mm. But actually, some analysis that was done for us by IPPR shows that whilst those low-paid, low-skilled sectors make up about 23% of the economy, they actually make up about a third of our productivity gap to Western European countries. Now, there's lots of questions to ask about why that is, but the fact that those low-skilled, low-paid sectors are actually responsible, or could be responsible for such a large part of our productivity gap is interesting, I think,
yeah.
And makes you think about, well, actually, what does that mean, and how can we maybe think about improving the experience of work at the bottom end of the labour market in order to deliver greater inclusive growth and to tackle this problem of in-work poverty, which really does kind of break a sort of social contract.
Yeah.
I think
the
final part of this is, and you know, there was probably a timer on how long it was going to be before one of us said this, but the final part of this is Brexit.
Well, let's get it out of the way.
So someone out there has just won.
They've won it. Yeah.
And you know, if you look at the places that voted overwhelmingly to leave in the referendum, you know, you see a skew towards low-income individuals, you see a skew towards people with low qualifications. But actually, we did some really interesting analysis with Matt Goodwin of some of the figures around this, and there is a place element to it as well. Those places that are sort of economically doing worse, everyone in those places was more likely to vote to leave.
Yeah.
And that suggests that there are places where a sense of opportunity, even where people have high skills, a sense of opportunity is passing them by. And that, I think, is one of the real drivers for kind of, it's very much the reason why Theresa May is talking about a UK that works for everybody. And it really is the reason why inclusive growth has suddenly become an issue of much greater debate.
And so that perspective, you know, we often latch on to, you know, the referendum vote or, you know, the Brexit vote, or we, you know, we think about the recession and obviously the effects that that's had. But your sense is that much of the concern or some of the concerns around inclusive growth are longer run in some respects. Much longer run, which is about automation, I think, to a degree. Globalisation, on the other hand, you know, where growth happens and the nature of growth and the effect that has on the labour market, particularly in countries like the UK.
Thinking historically as well, backwards towards those sort of patterns of deindustrialisation and the way in which we still see many of those patterns on different places in the UK today.
Yeah. You know, what's your take on, I mean, why is it now? I mean, it's interesting that, you know, at the global level, you know, you hear a lot saying, well, still, you know, we've increased people, brought people into the, you know, into the market economy. Look at the effects we've had in China and India and other places. And clearly, people in those places are massively better off than they were, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Whereas, you know, there's questions about who's getting hit in places like the UK or in places like the US or in other advanced economies. So, you know, just try and unpack a little bit of that.
Yeah, so I think there's a few, you know, Katie put it very well, but I think there's a few things which you could add to that. First is this sort of perception that maybe inequality is somehow a drag on growth.
Yeah.
So actually, you know, there's a famous study done by the IMF where they suggested that countries, you know, more unequal economies grew slower. And this is quite nice because it sort of provides some sort of econometric justification for policies in this area. So I think there's a sort of, you know, there's an issue there. And the other thing is this sort of move towards devolution, which we've seen in many countries. And this is partly driven by sort of dissatisfaction with what national governments are doing. And it's also driven by, I mean, you're going to love me for saying this, by a sort of, you know, increasing number of people who think that it's the best way to achieve national economic growth is to devolve powers to sort of cities and regions. And as that's happened, we've seen city and regional government is often more progressive, often has more of a concern and sort of, an immediacy around people who aren't benefiting quite so well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those two factors have sort of really sort of helped to sort of push this agenda forwards. I still think we've got a long way to go though with this sort of inclusive growth agenda. I think it's still sort of in its early, well, I hope it's still in its early days and that the sort of, you know, the clearer policy frameworks will develop and we'll start to get much more of a handle on how you do it, not just whether you should do it, but how you can make growth inclusive.
Yeah, and interesting, you kind of talking a little bit, you know, links to productivity and to job creation and such. And obviously there, you know, I think there are, is it partly about the proceeds of growth and how they get distributed, either in terms of, you know, you can think about it on the one hand around jobs, you know, who's getting the jobs, but also your point was about how wages as a share of profit or share of capital gets allocated to whether it goes to the worker or to the owner. So, you know, proceeds of growth question there. And obviously there are issues around, you know, careers. People are being able to get into good jobs that allow them to progress either in that job or by job hopping to, you know, across different labour markets. Is that part of the deal as well? You know, is it kind of the proceed element? People see people getting on and, you know, they wonder why their place or why they aren't getting on?
I think that's certainly part of it. And actually, I think this is part of the reason why inclusive growth and just growth are not necessarily the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's because you can grow an economy, it doesn't necessarily mean you're creating jobs.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are ways in which you can grow gross value added without necessarily creating lots of jobs.
Yeah.
So there's something there about what a sort of jobs-rich version of growth that produces good jobs looks like. There is also a question then about who's getting those jobs once you have created them. And so are you growing your economy by relying on outside migration in, or are you growing, or are you making sure that those jobs that are being created are available to people who are already living there, who perhaps are out of work, perhaps been long-term out of work?
Yeah.
You know, so I think thinking about how some of those things around who's getting jobs is a really, really important part of it. And the point you made about progression is also really important. We know that people who are low paid are often stuck in low pay for a very long period of time. So something like 3 out of 4 people fail to escape low pay over a 10-year period. That suggests that there is a problem with those career ladders and that ability to get from one job to the next job. Now, not everyone is always in a position where they are able to progress in their careers. People do have other things happening in their lives as well. So a lot of those people who are sort of stuck in low pay are actually people who have got caring responsibilities, for example. But there are also a lot of very young people who are experiencing in-work poverty, who want to be able to get on, who are stuck in low-paid work and are struggling to make that next step. So I think there's definitely a question about whether the structures are in place to support those who are wanting to and who are able to be able to get on, whilst also making sure that those who perhaps at the current time are not able to do that are able to still achieve a decent standard of living.
Mm. Neil, some thoughts on the, you know, this sort of question about who's getting the growth? Are they getting enough of it? You know, particularly, and I think we're talking It seems to me partly the idea, one of the ideas underneath inclusive growth, is a sort of relative idea associated with it. You know, some places and some people doing very well, and some places and some people doing less well. And it's the tension that's generated by that, the differences, that, that is part of the drive to try and deal with this sort of problem, this sort of issue.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a couple of things here. So, I mean, first is this long-term context of employment polarisation. So the decline of sort of mid-level jobs in things like manufacturing and bookkeeping, jobs which used to be sort of, you know, reasonably well-paid jobs for less well, you know, if I can put it like this, less well-educated people.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these jobs have gone. We've seen growth at the top, lots of growth at the top, which is a really good news story, and we've seen some growth at the bottom. Now, the sort of caveat there is that a lot of that growth in jobs at the bottom has been in jobs which are personal service jobs, which are reliant on sort of, you know, and there's two important things here. So first is that these jobs at the bottom, they're often reliant on being in sort of close proximity to the people at the top.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, you, if you're cleaning offices or being a security guard or, you know, cleaning, you know, looking after kids of people who go out to sort of well-paid jobs. So we're seeing this sort of, you know, first of all, we're seeing this issue that there's a, you know, there's this proximity effect, but at the same time, some people suggest that this sort of hollowing out of the middle of the income distribution has led to problems in terms of social mobility. And the evidence on this isn't clear and won't be clear for some time. But if you think about the sort of, you know, each different job being a sort of ladder up, so, you know, you can work in a low-paid job for a bit and you move up, and you know, to some in some respects, that's absolutely fine. That's how it should work. But if the sort of middle rungs disappear, then you'd, you know, that suggests that it's going to be harder for people to move up.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the big problem. Most people don't mind being low-paid for a bit. I mean, people have done, you know, but if it looks like you're going to be low-paid for a long time and it's going to be very hard to escape, particularly in some local economies where there aren't that many sort of good jobs you can move up to, then it becomes a really significant problem.
Yeah. And we'll come back, I think, you know, to think about the mechanisms for, you know, for dealing with some of those sorts of issues, because in a sense, you were saying right at the beginning, Katie, about, you know, employment is part of the answer, but it may not, you know, it's, that seems to be for some and for increasingly many, it's not the only answer. So the kind of mechanisms around that. I suppose get your thoughts on, does it matter to us when we think about the scale of, when we're thinking about inclusive growth, does it matter when we talk about different scales? Should we think, is this a national thing to be thinking about, or is it a city level thing? Because in a sense, you know, you get quite different. I give you a sense, you know, we did some work using some of the ONS stats to put together Gini coefficients for, you know, for cities. And, you know, when you talk about the most unequal cities in the UK are Cambridge, Oxford and London. They're also probably the most amongst the top five, at least successfully, economically successfully, and using sort of traditional measures of economic performance. Our most equal cities are places like Burnley, Stoke and Hull, which we know typically also have, you know, relatively high levels of unemployment, relatively low level wages, etc. So what does that tell us about the idea when we think about it at that sort of level? Are we missing the point? Are we using the wrong spatial scale to think about inclusive growth? I mean, I don't know. I mean, just get your kind of thoughts on it. You know, I hear this a lot around, you know, when you look at Greater Manchester, the polarity of poor places and rich places. And, you know, what does that tell us? Does that just tell us that people sort into different neighbourhoods at Greater Manchester? Well, yeah, it does. We know that, right? I mean, but does that mean we should be, you know, stopping growth at the top end in London and Cambridge? Is that the way to do it? Or, Katie, tough questions, but...
I think that question of inequality in cities, what it really tells you, as you pointed out, is that places like Burnley are less prosperous than places like Cambridge. Mm. So I'm not sure if that that metric of income inequality within a place like that is actually the most useful one in this conversation.
Yeah.
Actually, I think for us, what really matters is how you bring up the bottom. Really? So how you tackle issues of poverty and income adequacy for those who are struggling.
Yeah.
And there are certainly people out there who would argue that the income inequality is the most important thing for us. It's the poverty that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
Because that's the bit where it really feels like you are, as I said before, kind of breaking some sort of social contract if you are working, yet you're not able to actually make ends meet.
Yeah.
So I think there is something in there about the the metric that you use and getting the metrics right to tell the right to tell a sort of meaningful story about what inclusive growth means. That question, though, about different spatial scales, I think, is a very important one for a slightly different reason, which is that I think if you look, we did some work on struggling places, looking at sort of mapping where they are in the UK and looking at the places that are declining in relative terms. And what that showed is there are big differences between those places that are not doing so well, that are within the orbit of a large metropolitan, rapidly growing city. In those places, then, you know, you need to think about things like how do you connect them better to the opportunities that are available? How can you create complementary activities in those places that that will help to sort of grow the economy of the city overall and those places themselves? There is quite a different sort of challenge in those places that are rather more isolated and aren't in the orbit of a large city. So the place that kind of springs to mind is somewhere like perhaps Blackpool, which is obviously quite a long way from Manchester, not really commutable. So you know, what you do in a place like that is somewhat different. And I think having that kind of understanding of the different sorts of challenges and opportunities that present in different types of places and the role that they play within economies is a really important part of that. And the same applies actually within cities themselves, thinking about neighbourhoods. So a disconnected neighbourhood that where the, you know, the people who are living there are not accessing job opportunities nearby, or they're not anywhere near places that are centres of employment, have very different sorts of challenges to areas that have very high unemployment but are right on the doorstep of loads of jobs. You know, in the latter, it's about sort of skills and training and can you open up some of those opportunities. In the former, it's perhaps more, it probably could well still be about skills and training, but it might also be about transport. So I think, you know, really understanding the sort of different functions that different types of places play within a city and different types of cities is a really important part of understanding inclusive growth.
That's a great point.
I mean, there's a sort of interesting point which you sort of alluded to, which is about demand and demand for low-skilled jobs and whether you can create them. So, you know, places like Manchester, there's clearly demand for, you know, for people who are in the lower end of the labour market, which would hopefully sort of bid up their wages and sort of improve things. But in places like Hull, like Blackpool, there's a really important question about whether we can create jobs for, you know, good jobs for relatively low-skilled workers in these places. And I think that's quite a, you know, at the moment, it's a quite good policy agenda because we've got the industrial strategy. The RSA, I noticed, had some stuff about, was it place-based industrial strategy in their document. So, but really, I mean, you know, we've been looking at what the evidence base on this is, and actually, it hasn't really been tried. So we don't know. There isn't a very good evidence base on what you can do to create jobs at a sort of city level, which are for sort of low to middle income earners. So I think there's a sort of there's an important and sort of unresolved policy question there.
Yeah, no, I think it's a you know, it, as you say, you know, it's you can see how you might begin to address some of these issues where, you know, a degree of connection and linkage is part of the story. Not never enough, you know, in the sense it's never the only part of the story. But as you said, Neil, you know, it's a bigger question for us around about where, if there, that linkage and connection is not viable or not possible, then, you know, the questions become ordinarily much more difficult, not least because the jobs base or the employment base in many of those cities was historically industrial, you know, semi-skilled, easy in sort of entry, where the wages were reasonably high, productivity was actually reasonably high, so that, you know, wages could be slightly high. A lot of that has essentially gone overseas, or, you know, and is not, you know, is not coming back, is it? I mean, that's, you know, part of the you know, the perspective.
I mean, almost nobody thinks those jobs are coming back, apart from one person in Washington DC. Who's
Well, I think there are some national politicians in this country that have a sort of nostalgic view of the economy, and, you know, and place greater emphasis on, or particular emphasis on the industrial bit of industrial strategy, and think that we can once again become, you know, the hotbed of large scale manufacturing across the country and re-employ all the people that no longer is. But I don't know, it's a tough one.
And there are more challenges along this sort of agenda down the line. So if we look at the best paid jobs for low skilled males, as it were, sort of, you know, sorry about using the term low skilled, which isn't particularly precise, but, you know, stuff like, a lot of these jobs are driving jobs. And, you know, 30 years' time, who knows, it's, you know, these jobs are going to be automated or replaced with something else.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's good we're thinking about this agenda now because we're going to need it. Basically.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, interesting. We'll come back there because I want to get your thoughts on, part of the agenda is about standards of living in these localities, and there's a question about how we achieve that. Jobs and employment and growth is one mechanism, but there may be different mechanisms. We'll get your thoughts on it. But I'm interested in these sort of some of the assumptions and you've done some nice work looking at, for example, some tech, tech growth, yes, and the degree to which then it has any effect on poverty alleviation or poverty reduction in different places. Just say a little bit about that paper and get Katie to reflect on that more generally.
Well, one of the main approaches in economic development is you target high-end sectors, so high-tech, maybe the sort of digital economy, financial services, something like that. And the assumption is that if you grow this sort of skilled tech sector in your city, somehow the benefits will trickle down to other people. And, I've looked into this for the United States. I'm doing some work for the UK, which isn't out yet. But, essentially looking at whether this does actually improve living standards for less well-educated workers. And in the United States, so if you look at, this is a big hot agenda in places like San Jose and Silicon Valley, where you have homeless people living in the same neighbourhood as sort of people on huge, huge incomes working for some of the sort of tech startups. And basically what we find is that there's no, there are positive benefits in terms of wages, but it doesn't reach the people who are right at the bottom.
Yeah.
So you have to have an income. It sort of kicks in around, double the poverty line. And the US has quite tight poverty lines, so we need to be a bit careful about that. But what it shows is that there are benefits, but they're not reaching the people who are right at the bottom.
No.
So you can sell that as a positive story or a sort of negative story. But it's...
And do you buy, I know you've looked at this, but Moretti's studies, looking at the multiplier effects, saying one tech job, has knock-on effects not only for related professional services, the lawyers, the accountants, etc., but you see an effect more generally on local services and the numbers of jobs associated, with those sorts of activities. That's obviously a US study that he's, he's used and is quoted fairly frequently. What are your thoughts on that?
So, I think there's probably good evidence there is going to be a multiplier. It's probably not going to be anything like as big as Moretti claimed.
Yeah.
In his very nice book. I think, there's certainly going to be something happening. There may also be some sort of changing composition effect. So if you see, at the bottom of the labour market, it may change the type of jobs which are done.
Yeah.
So if you look in the sort of 2000s, for example, some of my colleagues did some work and they looked at, if you attract a public sector job, what does that do for the, in terms of other jobs?
Yeah.
And they said that, basically you gain 0.5 jobs for each public sector job. You gain half a job in non-tradable local jobs and you lose 0.4 other tradable jobs.
Yeah.
So essentially in the UK it sort of nets out at zero.
Zero.
There is some evidence for these multiplier effects, but they're nothing like as big as the United States.
No.
And we simply can't rely on them, I don't think, is the lesson here. Because a lot of the jobs which are created are not good jobs. They're sort of low productivity personal service jobs, which Katie was talking about earlier.
And what we certainly do know, you see this in the US, but you certainly see it in the UK, is in those sorts of cities where you see tech-related or professional services-related job growth, we certainly see cost of living going up rapidly, whether it's housing or whether it's congestion, which more often than not dwarf any wage effects, particularly at the lower end.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a sort of nice, if you think about if you want to be a low-paid worker, assuming you're in employment in Cambridge versus a low-paid worker in employment in Manchester or Warrington or somewhere, where the costs are much, much lower, then your real income is going to be much, much higher if you're in one of these supposedly less successful cities.
I think that's a really important point, because I think what it points to is that, we've sort of talked quite a lot about inclusive growth in terms of places that's sort of left behind, but actually this is an agenda that's not just about those places.
Absolutely.
It's actually an agenda that's about everywhere, because we do have problems with inclusive growth in our most prosperous cities as well as in our least prosperous cities. You only have to look at London, obviously booming economically in many senses, but has the highest poverty rate of any region of the UK, 27%.
Mm.
And a lot of that is to do with high housing costs in particular. But I think this idea that inclusive growth is different to growth, because if you just rely on growth, you're implicitly, the mechanism that you are relying on is trickle down.
Yep.
You're saying that the wealth, the benefits of that will trickle down. Everyone will, eventually will benefit in some way and we'll all be better off. And I think, you know, the research that you've just described kind of fits with what you just sort of see from observing the world, which is that, yes, that does happen, but it doesn't trickle far enough to reach to the sort of very bottom.
No.
And, like you say, has these sort of side effects of driving up costs and potentially congestion and other sort of negative externalities, which then have to be dealt with.
Yeah, yeah. So let's turn to what we might, how do we achieve inclusive, you know, inclusive growth? And I suppose, you know, there can be a bunch of, I suppose, macro policies around tax and all the rest, but I think, you know, say what you want to on that. But I suppose when we get down to localities or places, you know, what's the policy mix? I mean, is this in the commission, you know, identifying that it, you can't only think about economic and social separately, you have to think increasingly about them together. But Kitty, just give us a sense as to, you know, how you approach that, achieving inclusive growth. What's the mechanism and policy mix?
There are three elements that we think about at JRF. One is about demand and about how do you create more and better jobs. Mm-hmm. Some of that is, you know, going back to what I was talking about at the very beginning, thinking about productivity across the board, so not just the kind of, you know, what are your real kind of high-tech growing industries of the future, but also thinking about how do you improve productivity in order to improve wages in low productivity industries. But there's also a question on the demand side, I think, about how do you make the most of what you've already got? So how do you think about the role of, say, anchor institutions, those really big spenders and employers in any given place? How are they really making the most of their sort of muscle in the area and using that in order to drive inclusive growth locally? So there's kind of a bunch of stuff on around kind of more and better jobs. There is then, I think, a more traditional area that people who are in the economic development world are kind of more comfortable with, which is about how do you connect people who are experiencing poverty or people who are in some way disadvantaged to the economic opportunities that are being created. That's very much about employment support service, it's about skills, it's about transport and how, you know, whether people can actually physically get to jobs that are being created and all those sorts of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, there is a set of issues that are around people's prospects and that are about kind of thinking in the long term, how do you create the conditions so that people have the skills that employers will need, but also how do you make sure that people get off to a really good start in life? You know, some of the gaps that we see in employment open up by the time that children are aged 2 or 3, and they go on to grow as people go through school and then eventually enter the labour market. So thinking about that sort of very long-term prospects piece. So there's some activity around more and better jobs, activity around connecting people to opportunities, and then about education and skills and prospects. And then kind of wrapping around all of that is questions about leadership and governance, and how do you set the tone? How do you set out the ambition to deliver inclusive growth, and how do you then back that with the sorts of metrics that will make sure that you are delivering inclusive growth? And yeah, we've got the Metro Mayors coming in some cities in England in May of this year. I think, yeah, that's a really exciting opportunity to think about how a mayor can drive this kind of inclusive growth agenda. But it's not just about them, though. It's actually about kind of thinking about a whole city approach. Mm-hmm. Like I said, thinking about the role of anchor institutions, civil society, businesses, as well as local authorities and mayors.
Yeah. Neil, can I just pick anything up you agree with on that? Agreement and disagreement?
So, I mean, you know, I think in terms of how you achieve inclusive growth, I think we really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, there's clearly a role for this sort of, you know, if you were thinking about how you, you know, achieve this, you'd probably go back to some sort of completely different model of the German economy or the Swedish economy in the sort of, you know, early 2000s and sort of work from there. But I don't think we're anywhere near that. So it's very hard to see how we get from where we are, particularly with sort of, you know, spending constraints, etc., to a situation where we are focusing on inclusive growth. I mean, I just want to echo your point on metrics, because I think this is really crucial, actually. So, and getting the metrics right is going to be really significant. So we know that when we had a government which was committed to social policy, so the sort of, you know, Tony Blair's government of the 2000s, they hit most of the targets they aimed at, and they missed loads of the targets which they weren't shooting for. And sort of, there were all sorts of unintended consequences, of which the growth in sort of low pay was one. And I think this is crucial in terms of inclusive growth, because actually some of the ways you could set a target which was counterproductive for local government to sort of hit. So give you an example of China in the 2000s. China, you know, 500 million people, you know, were left poverty in that period in China. And this was not inclusive by a number of measures of inclusive growth, because people at the top were doing even better.
Yeah.
So we have to be really careful about how we set these metrics and how we sort of set these targets, because that's really what we sort of need to hold policy. Well, that's what we need to hold policymakers to account.
Yeah. So we'll come back to metrics. I just want to pick up or get your thought whether you see any, you know, trade-offs in some of what you were saying, Katie. And I mean, it's a genuine curiosity, you know, and I'm not fixed on these sorts of ideas, but you can clearly see some tension between, you know, your point about, you know, one of the ways we achieve productivity growth in low-wage economies is essentially to introduce much more capital into the into those industries, which is essentially automation and robots, which will do away with kind of the, you know, the labour that's required or the people required in that. So there's, I don't know, can I thought on that? Because I think there's an interesting question about, you know, the extent to which some of these industries are labour rich precisely because the wages are very low. And in a sense, once we push wages up to a point, that encourages capital replacement and such. And then, so there's a kind of, just your thoughts on that. My other thought would be, again, I'm not fixed on this, I haven't seen the evidence on it. But one thing that does sort of worry me around the anchor institutions, or for me, it's more of a, you know, the buy local sort of arguments, which is, you know, are we buying local or preferencing localities and doing things in localities and losing some of the efficiencies that we get from scale and transparency and, you know, and all of those. So that, again, the cost of service goes up, even if, you know, those that are receiving the service get a better service. There's a kind of interest. Give me some, what you think.
I think they're both very important questions. I'll deal with the second one first, because it's a bit easier, I think. I think the thing with anchors, I mean, there is a sort of prior point. It's not just about the procurement bit. It's also about the employment piece. And so I think, you know, there is a question about when you are, you know, when you've got entry-level jobs and you are bringing in people perhaps as apprentices, are you thinking about how you can make the most of those sorts of mechanisms in order to contribute to inclusive growth? You know, are you making those opportunities available to young people who are disadvantaged? Are you making those are you working with employment support providers to get people who have been out of the labour market for a long time with disabilities into the labour market? So there are those sorts of things which I think perhaps carry slightly less of a question than the procurement side. On the procurement, and do you actually just end up sort of being more costly and being less efficient? I think what we're talking about here is not sort of necessarily wholesale. Everything must be bought on your doorstep. We're talking about shifting a proportion of spend. And I think there are ways you can do that where you are asking in your process of procurement about questions about what the local benefit would be, and just factoring that into your decision making rather than it necessarily becoming the sole focus of your decision making. So just to pick up the point on automation, I think if you look at something like the retail sector, there's a really interesting and live example happening right there, which is that, you know, British Retail Consortium and the like are looking at how you drive up productivity. They are also asking questions about the rising cost of their of what it costs them to employ people. And they're certainly predicting that there will be potentially a lot of job losses as a result of those two things. So there clearly are some trade-offs here. Whether or not they're overstating that case, I think, is difficult to tell. And, you know, quite how many jobs, you know, you look at some projections, it's like 30% of jobs are going to be given over to robots across the economy as a whole. You know, it's very difficult to kind of gaze into that crystal ball. But I think there clearly are some trade-offs between capital and labour. But what you need, you know, the sort of place where you want to get to is rising productivity, which results in rising wages that then creates demand elsewhere.
So you might lose it in the classically retail or food retail, but you gain it somewhere else because of the excess, the aggregate demand.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Neil, thoughts on the trade-offs? I mean, in a sense, you know, one of, part of the critique is, you know, who could possibly argue against inclusive growth, and yet,
yeah.
and yet.
So I mean, there's a point here around inclusive growth avoiding hard choices, right? Mm. I mean, it's a, you know, it's no coincidence that inclusive growth has come around at a time when we have relatively constrained budgets in government, and we know that most of the way in which government has tended to equalise incomes is through the tax system, and you know, at the moment they're not keen on doing that. Because of that, you know, they're looking for other ways to sort of make people think they're on their side. Mm. And so there's a sort of critique of inclusive growth. It's avoiding hard choices, and it's sort of a smokescreen for this, you know, the government's unwillingness to take actually hard choices in terms of sort of tax and spend. I mean, you know, the other sort of, you know, just to go back to your point around sort of automation, I mean, we've got this situation where we've got lots of low productivity jobs. One of the sort of counter arguments is that, you know, what's happened is we've been very good at getting people into the labour market, and we've just been, so we've allowed employers to essentially run with a business model where they have lots of low-skilled, essentially, you know, disposable employees which they can sort of trade in and out.
And policies encourage that, right? We raise lower-end threshold on income tax to whatever it is, 12 and a bit thousand. That, you know, that reduces the cost of labour, right?
We've explicitly had a work-first policy, yeah. Right? You know, yeah. That's all that mattered. And this has meant that people, you know, have to work or are strongly encouraged to get into the labour market.
Yeah.
In other countries, they've not done that to nearly the same degree. So if you look at sort of Germany, where it's a much more tailored system, it's much more about getting people into jobs in which they could progress. So, you know, it's a, you know, one of the things about automation is that we, you know, it should be happening everywhere. And if you look at the outcomes somewhere like the UK, they seem to be a lot more stark than the outcomes in some other European countries. Yeah. So it does suggest that there are things we could be doing.
Yeah.
Can I just pick up that point about inclusive growth just sort of being a smokescreen? I mean, I think I certainly can hear what you're saying, but I think there's a quite fundamental point to this, which is that even with the best will in the world, you know, a more sustainable path to poverty reduction is to improve the quality of jobs at the bottom end of the labour market. Mm-hmm. We spend an awful lot of money topping up the incomes of low-income households who are in low pay in this country. And you're never going to replace that entirely through an inclusive growth approach. You're always probably going to need some topping up of the incomes of working people and supporting them with high costs of housing and so on and so forth. But certainly, if we can improve the quality of work and at the bottom end of the labour market, then you can actually begin to reduce some of that cost. So it's a more sustainable path to higher living standards than simply putting it all back into the social security system. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not just about, it is partly about austerity, but it's also partly about politics and what's politically acceptable.
Yeah.
And I think actually we've seen from the last 7 years the debate around social security and benefits in the welfare system. And I think there is a real challenge about the size of the social security bill and what is what's acceptable to people. Some of that clearly is about how we talk about these things, because people don't tend to think about pensions in the same way as they think about unemployment benefit. But some of it also is just about what is a sustainable size of a sustainable budget and sustainable amount of money to be spending.
Mm-hmm. And Neil?
I mean, if I could just sort of come back with another sort of critique of inclusive growth, which is that, you know, we're talking about inclusive growth in cities, and I sort of raised this suggestion earlier that somewhere like Blackpool could try and raise demand for labour in certain sort of jobs. And the inclusive growth agenda sells this sort of bullish story that Blackpool could somehow create growth which is also inclusive. And yet you look back on Blackpool and it has struggled to have any form of growth over the last sort of 15 years. Mm. So the idea that it could somehow make this growth inclusive just seems to me overconfident and perhaps sort of, you know, mistaken, frankly.
Well, and I wonder whether, you know, it can't be coincidental that issues around distribution seem to rise to the fore, who's getting what, when overall growth seems to be more curtailed and more constrained, in a sense where people often worry, or one worries more about who's getting what when the pie, in a sense, the overall pie is not necessarily shrinking, but it's certainly not growing. Whereas, you know, in the past when the economy was growing at 2 and a bit or whatever it might have been, you know, pre the recession, we still had these differentials between places and between people. It just seemed, we seem to be a bit more relaxed about that. And I wonder whether let's assume, let's be very optimistic and assume that the national economy grows again at 2 and 2.5%, whether these concerns will just drift back into the background. And I'm not saying it should do that, but I just wonder whether we're just in a moment where, you know, we see this, and we see this in some respects in our politics as well, about who gets what, and it, you know, it becomes much more fractured, much more difficult to have those conversations.
I mean, I think the political and economic moment that we're in certainly heightens the, you know, it makes it more acute, it makes it more immediate. I don't think these are not problems, though, that have suddenly appeared as a result of the financial crisis. You know, if you look at things like you know, the long tail of low productivity firms, if you look at the rise of in-work poverty, that's been, you know, over a decade, well over a decade in the coming. So it's, you know, these are not new recent problems. So I think the sort of financial crisis and the austerity that then followed makes us more acutely aware of it, but I think there would be challenges either way. And I think one thing I would say there, just on the kind of the Blackpool point, is that, you know, policy isn't simply about economic growth. I hate to tell you this.
I agree.
And I think there is, you know, there is a question about how far you, you know, you have a sort of a growth strategy or industrial strategy that is seeking to grow the places that have the greatest potential, to kind of leverage those agglomeration effects and connect people into it. There will always be places that stand outside of that. And I think the question we have to ask ourselves is, what is the strategy for those places?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. We'll close on this. So I wonder what your thoughts are on, well, I don't know if Joseph Bronte have done work on this, on universal basic income, whether that's the answer to, you know, to some of these sorts of places. I've been sort of mulling this over as, you know, as a way of responding to some of these places where the answer isn't immediately growth. But it is undoubtedly, it is about standards of living. It is about, you know, realization. It is about supporting individuals, etc., etc. But that may not be the immediate answer. May not be employment, or at least an employment path.
We have done some work on universal basic income. We have found it to be an expensive and politically not very viable policy that we are also not convinced it would actually be very beneficial for reducing poverty.
Cool. Okay.
We could probably do a whole other podcast on that one.
Yeah, no, we could. Well, we will. So we'll better, get you back.
Better, I think, to focus on how we can build on the opportunities that there are in within all different sorts of places, and but also to really think hard about the education and the skills side of this, because long term that's one of the biggest drivers. And yeah, I think to sort of write off certain parts of the country and say, oh, well, the people there, we'll just give them a universal basic income and we'll not worry about it, I think is not not a satisfactory answer, particularly because, you know, we know work is, even with the kind of less than ideal forms of work that we have, work still remains the most reliable route out of poverty. So ensuring people have access to employment and have the skills and the opportunities to be able to progress once they are in work still remains the priority.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree with that. I suppose my one additional thought on that would be, for certain, we need to ensure that the people living in Blackpool get the very best skills and education that we possibly can get them. But doesn't mean that they're going to then take their careers in Blackpool as well. Thoughts on that, Neil?
People move. I did. You did. We all have moved to, you know, highly skilled people tend to move. Well, highly skilled people and us tend to move to sort of, you know, places where we can make best use of our skills. That often, you know, that doesn't always happen to people who are less well skilled. They don't move for university. They don't have the same sort of, you know, economic returns from moving, and because of that they're less likely to sort of, you know, it's great if you're sort of a relatively low skilled person who lives in an economy which is doing really well, but if you are sort of somewhere which is doing less, you know, having less economic success, it can be challenging. I think there's a, you know, if policy does help people move and help people sort of, you know, end up somewhere else, and that can sometimes be a good thing. I mean, in the US they have, you know, proper training schemes which involve people being subsidised to move to different parts of the United States if they can get a good job there. There's no reason we couldn't try something like that here.
Okay, final thoughts from you on how we, what do we need to do to ensure that, you know, the issues that we've talked about, and we, you know, under the term inclusive growth, you know, don't go away or don't get lost as the conversation and the agenda evolves? How do we make sure that the issues that we've talked about are still at the front of politicians' minds at the national level as well as at the local level? What do we need to do?
Well, I think the fact that there is just a simple fact of political life that they will have people coming into their surgeries talking about the situation that they are in when they are, you know, working all hours and not able to make ends meet. That in itself, I think, will certainly keep the issue on the agenda for some time. I think it, you know, says a lot about why the government is talking about a UK that works for everyone, and we really welcome the fact that they are talking about that. I think there are a couple of big opportunities facing us. One is the industrial strategy green paper, which is currently out, thinking about how you build inclusive growth into the measures that are being put forward in that green paper, I think is something that we're certainly going to be thinking a lot about over the next coming months. The other big opportunity, I think, is Metro Mayors, though. Yeah. I think that creation of a new a new political sort of focus for those big cities and those big city regions will actually really has the potential to really put the boosters under inclusive growth. Mm. And we certainly would be urging the mayors to make it the kind of hallmark of their administrations.
Mm, very good. Neil, additional thoughts on maintaining a focus on the issues?
Yes, I mean, so inclusive growth is a sort of clear, strong rationale for it. The time's clearly a good one to sort of take it forward, but there's still some sort of big problems with the agenda, which I think need to be overcome. One is this sort of issue around sort of the policy frameworks. You know, we still don't really know what works in terms of inclusive growth. You know, there's huge amounts of research at a national level. They've not come to any sort of agreed conclusions. We're sort of, you know, it's something similar at a sort of local level. What works is still sort of, you know, an open question. And also this problem that we're really, you know, there's a danger that it becomes too much of a sort of overconfident agenda, and that we believe that we can somehow solve the problems of these sort of declining towns or cities through achieving inclusive growth. And we know that it's been hard enough to achieve growth, so achieving inclusive growth is going to be even harder.
And on that note, my guests today have been Katie Schmucker and Neil Lee. Thanks for being part of City Talks. Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.